It's an interesting thing that among all the people that we know, being interested as we are in living healthfully and eating a healthful diet and so on, among so many people that one meets in health food stores and at health seminars and National Health Federation gatherings and so on, that there are so many sickly-looking healthy people, or at least I should say health-minded people. I'm reminded of one time where Master talked about meeting a man who announced proudly, "I've cheated St. Peter 3 times with carrot juice." And Master said, "Listen, when St. Peter wants you, you can bathe in carrot juice. It won't do you any good." And the problem, he mentioned that people who are too much into health foods, too much into all the right physical means of attaining radiant well-being, that he said, for instance, they'll be at work and say, "Oh dear, I didn't get my avocados this morning. My spine feels weak." They're so dependent upon physical means of attaining radiant well-being that they don't stop to consider, they aren't aware even, that radiation is not a physical thing. Radiance is light. Radiance is energy. Radiance is a more spiritual and mental quality. And if you put all your energy into just a physical means of attaining these things, then you won't. A person can be healthy, yes, in the sense of not being unwell by eating all the right things and doing all the right things physically. But he will only attain that quality of being radiantly healthy, radiantly well, shining and magnetic, if he relies on other means of attaining those goals. Now, I don't at all mean to say, therefore, forget good diet, forget right health means, and so on. Those are necessary only in the sense of removing conditions that block your energy flow. But they are necessary for that. It's important to eat properly. It's important to take care of your body in a physical way with proper exercise and so on. What is also important, however, is to understand that that isn't going to do it for you. People are always looking. In fact, this is one of the first things that people do when they come on the spiritual path, is try to attain spiritual states by purifying their bodies. Dieting and fasting and going on as I did when I first came on the path, the grape cure and so on. But these things are not going to give you that kind of consciousness. They may make it easier for you to attain that state of consciousness. And if your body is unwell, it's going to be much harder to attain that state of consciousness. If you eat foods that are debilitating, foods that have no vitality, if you eat a lot of white flour and white sugar and white rice and so on, things that are very deficient in food value and also just gum up your system, all one has to do is take some white flour and mix it with water and see what happens. This is what happens in people's stomach when they eat white flour a lot, white flour products. But yes, it's important to understand that and eat properly, but what the mistake that people make is to make a religion of this, because it's so much easier to eat right than it is to develop devotion. It's so much easier to eat the right kinds of foods than it is to have and to develop the right kind of mental diet. To eat your balance of protein and carbohydrates is a lot easier than overcoming hatred or jealousy or anger or pride or all those things that really prevent a person from attaining that state of consciousness that he wants. That quality of radiance that we're talking about then must be understood in a more mental and spiritual way. And when I talk of secrets of radiant well-being, what I want to emphasize above all is more this aspect of it. How to make that light shine through your being, how to be in the consciousness of light all the time. I have seen some people who never were sick a day in their lives, and yet they didn't give any sense of radiance. And I've seen other people who were literally on their deathbeds who were radiant. I would like to be well and radiant. I think this is the obvious balance we would like to strive for. But I do want to emphasize the importance of both and the greater importance of the spiritual over the physical. A person who has this quality of radiance can be like Saint Francis, who was very, very ill and yet never lost his joy. He was being tormented by rats, by blindness, by disease, by the impossibly painful kinds of so-called cures that people tried to inflict on him, and yet he never lost his joy. This is the kind of quality that is really important in life, because we never know how life is going to treat us. There was one man who claimed that he would live to be 100 years old because he ate just the right things. Well, he might have done so, but he got run over by a car at the age of 54 and was killed. You just never know what's going to happen. And the important thing is to make not only your peace, but your joy with God right now. If you can have that consciousness wherever you go, you will be with Him. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says that those who worship the lower gods go to their gods. In other words, those people who worship ancestors, when they die, they go to a world where they just meet ancestors. Well, what's different from that and the coffee klatch you used to enjoy in this world? When you worship lower astral beings, nature spirits, and so on, then you go there. And maybe you eat better peas, I don't know. But it says in the Bhagavad Gita, those who worship me come to me. That means to say those who worship the infinite merge in the infinite and attain that infinite joy. Well, the test of these teachings is here, right here and right now. And we can see the proof of it also in this respect, that those who worship anything, worship, you see, means not just a sense of getting down on your knees and bowing. It means putting your complete concentration, being absorbed in whatever it is that you are doing. I noticed in India, for example, they said that if you buy astrological gemstones, before wearing them, worship them. And I thought, my goodness, with my Christian background, this seemed like an absurd thing to do, worship a stone. But what they meant was, and they were just using words in the way they were capable of using them, because they have other meanings in their languages. But what they meant was, attune yourself to it, be absorbed in it, give it your blessings, and try to feel whatever spiritual qualities come from the stone, and then you will be able to do to get better effect from it. They would say, worship food before eating it. It sounds absurd, but then if you understand the meaning, it means try to draw yourself into attunement with the vibrations of what you're eating, and then you'll get much more out of it. And so, those who worship food, those who think only in terms of health food, then it's not a question of going to a health foodist's Eden when you die. There may be such a place, I don't know. No harm, they're doing a good thing with their lives if they live that way. But even here, what I have seen is that people end up sort of looking like like health food in some way. Reminded me of some lady who was very active in La Leche. Is that the name of that organization? And I'm all for breastfeeding. I think it's a great thing and so on. I don't at all mean to mock it. I think it's far better than feeding a baby out of a bottle. I think it's the only thing is that to make that the pivotal focus of your life seems a bit strange. And this lady who did that somehow had the very aura of a baby factory. Whatever we put our minds on, that's what we become. And so if we want to really radiate, we have to live on that level. We can't expect it to happen automatically just because we are living in a physically healthful way. We have to live in the consciousness of light. If we live in that consciousness, we have that radiance. I've seen saints who were unwell, who were going through all sorts of troubles physically, and yet were always beaming and smiling. Swami Ramdas is an example. He was a beautiful saint. Very, very simple, very childlike. When I met him, he didn't put on any airs. You'd expect a famous person known throughout the world for his wonderful books to somehow look important and dignified and so on. When he came waddling out of that elevator in Los Angeles like a duck, no teeth and grinning happily, I was absolutely amazed and then completely captivated. I was serving dinner. He was eating with Diamata. And I asked him halfway through the meal how he was doing. In other words, was there anything he wanted or anything? And how are you doing, I said. And he looked up with this toothless smile, swimmingly. And he was so blissful. I remember driving him back to his hotel. And he was sitting in the back of the car with his disciple Krishnabai, Mother Krishnabai. And they were talking in their own language, so that I didn't understand anything that they were saying. But that helped in a way, because that way I could just think about the vibrations I was feeling. And I felt so blissful. It was the first time since being with Master that I had felt such powerful vibrations of joy. And I realized that that was the important thing. And this body that was so sort of funny looking, cute, but it had given him lots of trouble in his life. It just didn't matter. Because the consciousness that he was living in was the consciousness of bliss. Well, that's what we want to really have. Otherwise, we have a smoothly running, efficiently running machine. But I've seen a lot of men, especially, who buy expensive camera equipment and somehow seem to convey in their attitude that they're already good photographers because they have this good equipment. And of course that isn't true. You know, an interesting thing I heard on the radio when I was in Australia, just as a sideline, a woman was being interviewed. She'd written a book on women photographers. And she said that she noticed one great difference. She was pointing out how very good some of these women photographers were, but she noticed one particular difference between the women photographers and the men photographers. And that was that the men were absolutely fascinated by the technology of photography. And the women couldn't have cared less. They mastered it because they had to, but their interest wasn't in the technology, it was in the subjects. And as a result, many times their photographs were a lot more sensitive. But I had to smile because I had to admit to myself, yes, I too was fascinated by the technology of the taking of pictures. But I've noticed a lot of people who think that they're already good because they've got the right equipment. And so I've noticed a lot of people also in the matter of health and well-being who think that they are well just because they aren't unwell, who think that they are well just because their bodies are functioning properly, because they're doing all the right things outwardly, and yet I don't see light necessarily in their eyes. Yes, it's much more difficult to live joyfully if you have an unwell body. Understand, I'm giving a balanced approach, not a one-sided approach toward the opposite extreme. But if I talk more on the opposite side, it's because all those people who are likely to come to a lecture here would already accept as a given the importance of eating right and living right in an outward way. And many people will err too far in that direction. Therefore, the correction that's needed is not as if I were talking to friends of my parents who don't know anything about right diet, and therefore I would spend a great deal of time talking about the importance of a vegetarian diet and so on. Here I don't need to talk like that, at least I presume I don't. There may be one or two heathens in the crowd. But anyway, when it comes to the question of radiant well-being, there are several aspects that we need to take into account. One is that we not impair the flow of energy. And diet is important in that respect. Because if you eat a lot of food that's devitalized, you're clogging not only your physical, your veins and so on, you're also even blocking your nervous system, making your whole consciousness heavy, and it will take a great deal more willpower to rise above that kind of block. The next thing is to introduce more energy into your body. It isn't only the blocking, it's also creating more. But if you have a lot of energy and a block, then you may find, for example, meat is high in energy, and yet it's also high in toxins. And as a result, although you've introduced all this energy into your body, you're blocking that with all these toxins, and meat eaters, as a rule, tend to have much less energy than vegetarians. A lot of people who don't know the value of a vegetarian diet will try to insist that you need meat because you need the energy. They don't know, they don't take into account how much or how little of that energy you can actually use once you've got it in your system. A friend of mine who came here to Ananda years ago used to be a football player on the football team for San Jose State. He weighed about 220, I think, when he was on the football team, and he ate a lot of meat, raw meat and meat all day long, and he thought he needed it to keep himself fit. And then he read a couple of books on yoga and diet and became completely changed and gave up meat altogether and lost a lot of weight. He went down to, 180 or something pounds. But he said that he had a great deal more strength, a great deal more energy. He had needed to sleep a large part of the afternoon. Now he didn't need to sleep anymore. And this is what I've found with people. Over the years, I myself have never gone back to eating meat since taking up a vegetarian diet 32 years ago. So I don't have that contrast. It was interesting, by the way, in Rome, last March, I ate fish for the first time in 32 years deliberately. Once or twice I took a mouthful or two before I realized it was fish. But there I ate fish deliberately for the first time because I had a choice of values. There was a lady who was very emotional who invited me to dinner. She didn't know that I didn't eat fish, and she served me a tuna casserole. And I had a choice between not eating the fish and upsetting her, because she'd done nothing else. She'd spent the whole day preparing this meal, but it all centered in that tuna casserole, or eating the fish just so as not to upset her. Well, I decided that it would be a greater error to just upset her all the more, so I ate the casserole, but I was sick all night long afterwards. It's interesting how, when you haven't eaten that kind of diet, how very differently it affects you. Anyway, I haven't had the experience personally of going back to it, but I have talked to a lot of people who became vegetarian for a while and then, because it was such an inconvenient thing socially, went back to eating meat. And many of them have told me that they felt much more sluggish, much heavier in their consciousness after going back to eating meat, once they were able to make that contrast between that and a vegetarian diet. I believe that it's a very important thing to give up eating meat, but if you have to eat meat for one reason or another, and it may be better anyway not to give it up too quickly, a gradual change is usually better. But if you do give it up, then don't eat, if you do eat meat, don't eat beef or pork. These are the two worst. Veal, of course, is beef too. Those meats should not be touched. Pork is very full of toxins, very full of poisons. Master made the rather unpleasant observation that is the reason that ham is so sweet is because of all the pus in it. And he said that, pleasant thought. He said something that has come out more recently in the papers. I've read it recently. But he said he had gone into slaughterhouses just to see this happening. And he saw them literally scooping cancers out of cows before selling their meat. And he said that people who eat cow meat especially are going to be much more prone to cancer. So he said it's very important not to eat beef, if you can possibly do it. So some people eat beef all their lives and don't get cancer. Well, karma enters into it too, don't forget. But some people can just be in the near proximity of germs and get killed, and others can be surrounded by them and not. It's a question of karma, it's a question of many things. But nonetheless, why subject yourself deliberately to such an influence? If you do eat meat, it would be far better to eat poultry or fish. And fish, in fact, in Bengal and other parts of the world where they emphasize a vegetarian diet, fish is often eaten and almost considered vegetarian. I myself couldn't. I remember when I was just a little child of 4 or something, going fishing in Lake Snagov with my dad and catching a little fish about 3 inches long and watching it wiggle there, and I felt so badly for the poor thing that I just couldn't eat it. It's somehow different when you see them moving, even worse when you hear them screaming, than eating a vegetable, even though the vegetable also feels some pain. But we have to eat something. The truth is that they don't feel nearly as much pain as moving creatures do. Our nervous systems are more highly developed. Now, energy, however, is the real secret of radiant well-being. The more the energy of a person, the more happy he is going to be. You can see this difference in their eyes. You'll never find a person whom you could conceivably call radiant who's sitting there saying, "Well, I don't know, I feel kind of tired today." Always you will find that if they are radiant, they are energetic. The two are synonymous. Life and energy are synonymous. And when you find somebody who has a lot of energy, you automatically think of them as radiant, and you automatically think of them as magnetic. Radiation, radiance, magnetism, all these things relate to that simple question of energy. Energy is blocked by the wrong kind of food, the wrong kind of living, not getting enough, enough sunshine, enough oxygen, all sorts of rules of that type that I don't need to talk to you about. I remember reading Renee Taylor's book on the Hunzas, and these paperback distributors, I presume it was their fault and not hers, in order to get more sales, had written on the jacket, on the cover, the long-suppressed secrets of the Hunzas. Well, whoever did the suppressing? The fact that they couldn't get in there except on muleback, that's not suppressing it. And so, we know those things. We know what they taught pretty well. We know what... we don't want to be fanatics on these subjects, but we know some of almost all the various health teachings going on because we read those things. I remember, by the way, in San Francisco a year ago, August, at the National Health Federation. I gave a lecture there. And by the way, I've become a very popular speaker for the National Health Federation. I guess they like this more balanced approach because I'm not there speaking about one particular thing. But there was a woman who came up to me after the talk who was into one special thing. I had finished speaking and those who had come were all starting to leave the hall. And this woman came up to me and she said, "This is the sort of thing, if you see it in a movie, you think, oh, that's funny, but it couldn't possibly happen." Well, this really did happen. She said, "Were you the fellow who was giving that talk up there?" "Yes." "That's a bunch of hokum! That isn't where it's at. It's Laetril. Everybody, come back, come back. Spread the word. It's Laetril." And if... this idea that if you take Laetril, you'll have all the problems of the universe solved. Well, we know that's not so. I don't need to give you secrets of that type. Certainly not long-suppressed secrets. What I want to do is talk about these more subtle aspects. And so when I speak of diet, I'm not going to emphasize the need for chemical balances. I'm not even sure I know them myself. Or for vegetarian versus meat diet, I'm not going to talk about that much, though I certainly know something about that. But I'd like to mention more again this aspect of it, the more spiritual aspect. When you're eating food, you're eating energy. High energy foods are more magnetic. I used to wonder why Master said that. Then I came to understand through reading physics and so on that magnetism is really a result of energy. You send electricity through a wire, it creates a magnetic field. And you fill your body with energy. Allow the energy to flow freely through your body, and you become magnetic. You block that free flow of energy, and you lose your magnetism. As a result of that, your aura, which you've all heard about, begins to weaken. And as a result of that weakened aura, which is really your magnetic field, all kinds of things can begin to come into your body. If you want radiant well-being, then you have to think more in terms of aura. Then you have to think more in terms of magnetism and energy and this flow that is non-material that you'll have with you after you leave your physical body. And the food that you eat should be thought of not only in terms of protein and carbohydrate balance and so on. It should be thought of as energy. It should be thought of also from the standpoint that there are different levels, different kinds of energy. For example, yogis say that in eating meat, you are eating the body of an animal that is more highly evolved and therefore more capable of feeling intense emotion. The emotion registered on very sensitive graphs when they've placed electrodes on plants, it can be registered, you can see it, but it's not nearly as intense as a cow or a pig. A pig is a very intelligent animal. Cows less so, perhaps, but still they have a highly developed nervous system. And the anger that they feel is a vibration that goes into their bodies, the fear that they feel. Somebody said, oh, but they don't even know they're going to be killed. Somebody told me that she had heard this. She said, I live on a route where they drive the trucks with the cattle to slaughter. And she said, I can tell the fear in their lowing as they're driving past. They know they're going for something different. It's not like being like the sound that I hear when they're being taken from the farm somewhere. It's a very different kind of sound. A friend of mine in India told me that they had a goat that they loved, and the goat was very friendly, and they'd take the goat different places. Well, one day, the goat had been raised for a goat sacrifice, which is a sad thing, and he wasn't into it, but apparently older people in the family were. Anyway, they took the goat to be sacrificed. Well, the day that they came to take the goat to be sacrificed, the goat fought against being taken. The first time, it had always gone happily, but when they tried to drag the goat away to be sacrificed, it was tugging on the rope and trying its hardest not to go. Animals have a lot of sensitivity, and they have a kind of intuition that we don't have because we use our minds so much. We break the flow of consciousness up with our reason, and so we lack that kind of intuition that many animals have. We develop it when we can go beyond reason and live more on an intuitive level. But Americans, who are so super rational, are, I've observed in my travels around the world, much less intuitive on the whole than many parts of the world where they emphasize more intuition, artistic sensitivity, and so on. So, anyway, when you eat food, you're eating vibrations. When you eat meat, you're eating those qualities that will help to make you also, in a spiritual and mental way, more subject to anger and fear and all sorts of violent, disharmonious emotions. Therefore, it's important also to eat a vegetarian diet. People who eat a vegetarian diet are also much more peaceful, and for those who want to develop spiritually, this is something that is very important to us. But also the kinds of foods that you eat in the vegetable kingdom, in the fruit kingdom, some of them have different qualities. In my lessons, I've gone into that. Things that Master said, that different fruits develop different mental traits. When you cook your food, you put vibrations into your food. And to cook your food consciously, that is to say, when you're cooking, try to put your love into the food. Try to bless the food that you're preparing for people. That will be something. That's why many saints in India like to cook for their guests and for their disciples, because they're able to put their blessings into the food, and that blessing goes into the body, and somehow you feel good. You eat food that's been blessed by a saint, and even if it doesn't taste good, you feel wonderful. The chances are it will taste good. I've met an awful lot of good cooks among the Swamis of India. But the important thing is the vibration that you get. Another thing, though, is the consciousness with which you eat. If you eat concentrating on the food, I've heard it said that when you chew your food, that's when you get the vibrations. So in the act of chewing, try to draw the energy from the food, vibrations and energy. and chew it with that consciousness. In India, they say it's important not to speak when you eat. Concentrate on what you're eating and on the energy that you're drawing from it, the vibrations that you're drawing from it. You'll get a lot more benefit from it. You may find that you don't need to eat as much. A very important aspect of this kind of thinking, then, is to eat food that is palatable. And I've noticed among a lot of people who are strong on health foods that there is a sort of pride in eating something that's unpalatable. As if I pampered my palate for all those years eating nothing but pastries and steaks, and now I'm going to show how good I am by eating garbage. And I read a book by one man who was so strongly into salads, and he said, very condescending, well, of course, if there are some people who can't eat this kind of bland diet, and for them it's all right if they have to add a few little natural herbs to your salad. Well, for heaven's sake, what's wrong with it? There could only be a kind of egotistical smugness in saying, I can eat it more unpalatable than you can. Otherwise, herbs are certainly good for you. And why not put them in the salad if they make it taste better? Your food should taste good, it should look good. Sometimes you will find that people will cook a very healthful diet. Keshava made me a salad one time, which was certainly a good salad as far as all the right ingredients. But it looked like slop. There was just no appeal to the eye. Nor, while I'm at it, to the taste, but that's... The preparation of food, in Hawaii, for example, when they give you a fruit salad, they put a little purple orchid on it, and it looks nice, and your eyes say, oh, how charming, and your whole body becomes receptive, and when it's receptive, it takes those vibrations in, it takes the energy in, and uses it. But if there's that thought of, oh, do I have to eat that, there is a rejection, which makes it sort of, well, when you've got an unwelcome guest appear on the scene, you sort of hustle him through as fast as you can. And that's what your body does with the food that it takes in if it's not pleased with the food. There is a message that goes through your whole nervous system, let's get rid of this fellow as soon as possible. And so you don't take the best from that food. So think of your food in terms of consciousness, the way you prepare it, the way you present it, the environment that you eat in. You go to so many restaurants and there you are trying to eat peacefully and there's this music going on, rock blaring at you. And how can you really digest your food well when your stomach is churning in knots? Whether appreciatively or unappreciatively, I'm sure there's some sort of churning going on with all that maelstrom of vibration going on around you. Try to eat also when you're happy. If you're feeling emotionally upset, it's better not to eat. You'll be secreting the wrong kinds of acids, you'll be digesting your food badly. Wait until you're calm and eat in a place and with people in vibrations that are all conducive to harmony. This will put you in tune with the consciousness of energy, with the consciousness of joy, and that alone is what will make you radiant. You will never be radiant if you only have your avocados in proper number and sequence. You will be radiant if you have the consciousness of always being joyful. Magnetism is a question of energy primarily, but energy is a question of attuning yourself to the cosmic source of energy. Master's teachings of energization exercises are really wonderful in this respect. We are surrounded by energy all the time. This great universe is a vast ocean of energy. The whole universe is really to be understood in the deeper level, not as a physical phenomenon at all. It is entirely just a vast sea of electromagnetic forces, which are actually, again, on a deeper level still, only manifestations of consciousness, because everything is really a dream in the mind of the Creator. And if we understand that, then we should never be tired again. We can learn to live by that energy. Master taught a number of things in the lessons, in the SRF lessons. He said that as man advances more in spiritual understanding, he will grow more and more toward the point where he won't need to eat at all. And he said there are certain techniques he offered certain techniques for drawing energy into the body at will and learning to live less by outward sustenance of food and oxygen and so on. He also taught ways of drawing energy from oxygen. He said that if you concentrate on the air that you breathe, you'll draw a lot more energy than if you breathe just sort of absent-mindedly. Learn to breathe consciously. Learn to feel as you inhale that you're distilling the oxygen and the energy from that oxygen and sending it throughout your body. That's why that breathing, that double breathing exercise at the end of the energization exercises is really beneficial. Even though you're not doing anything except relaxing and slowing your heart down, but if you do that, say, 6 to 12 times, just a short breath inhalation, bringing your hands up to the chest or to the shoulders, and then sending them out, concentrating at the point between the eyebrows. But as you inhale, feel consciously that you're sending this energy throughout the body. That's why also that thing in my book on yoga posture for self-awareness, the deep breathing where I speak of bending forward and then slowly feeling that you're filling your whole body with air as you stand up and finally lift your hands above your head and feel that the air is being filled, filling your body all the way up to the fingertips, so that your whole body is just vibrant with that energy. You'll draw a lot more from the energy that way. Master spoke of another way of leaning forward and then straightening up as you inhale and filling your whole body. Same system. He said that if you concentrate when sunbathing, concentrate on the energy that you're drawing from the sun's rays, you'll be able to draw as much as 100 times more energy from the sun than if you just lie there soaking it up passively. Everything that you do, if you do it consciously, you draw a lot more energy. There's another aspect that I forgot to mention. I spoke of not blocking the energy. Blocking can be done by wrong diet, by even negative thoughts and so on. But there's another thing, and that is concentrating that energy. We have a tendency to dilute our energy by trying to do too many things at once, or by wishing we didn't have to do what we are doing and know we have to do anyway, trying with one part of our mind to learn something and with the other part telling ourselves it's difficult. Remember that story of mine from the path where I learned enough Greek in one evening to pass the exam the next day. And the reason I did it was by telling myself I'm a Greek, and in the process, overcoming that thought of it's difficult, it's foreign, why am I doing this? So that all my mental effort was in one direction instead of blocking it by making it two-directional. And it was amazing how much I could absorb. A friend of mine in school, when he was in school, he wasn't a schoolmate of mine, told me that one day one night he woke up and he saw the captain of their football team living in the same dormitory with him, getting up from bed in his sleep. He had been wont to walk in his sleep, and so this friend of mine wanted to follow him and see where he went. And this man, who was very strong, being the captain of the football team, he had to be. He walked downstairs and he got to the front door. He wanted to go out, but they had bolted it with about a 2-inch thick iron bolt. And this captain wanted to get out, and he took his hands on that bolt and bent it double. Now, nobody, even a strong man like that, would be able to bend a 2-inch bar of iron double like that in his normal state of mind. How is it that a person under hypnosis is so much stronger? It's been often observed that under hypnosis people can do extraordinary things, or under the influence of an intense emotion. I mentioned in Sacramento a year ago, how when I was working on a church in Hollywood, building the India Center there in Hollywood, a girl of 15 crossed the street just as a car was rounding the corner, and the car knocked her over and dragged her about 60 feet or so, and she was lying pinned under the front of the car. And one of the boys working on the job there, a strong man, but certainly not this strong, it was not a Volkswagen, it was a big American car, he went to the front end of the car and picked it up and pushed it off her. And he could never have done that normally. He was able to do it then because he didn't have time to stop and tell himself he couldn't do it. That is to say, so often we are blocked by that thought of, I can't, and if we could just say, I can and I will, all that energy would go in one direction. We'd have a tremendous amount of energy. I mentioned that story of the bus in Pakistan that got stuck in a riverbed, and the passengers got out to push, and the bus was, they were pushing and pushing, and the bus didn't move an inch, and finally the driver stepped back to look at it, and he found that half the passengers were pushing from the rear, but the other half were pushing from the front. And that's how so much of our effort is directed in this life. A curious thing about this particular class in Sacramento was that when I got home, somebody showed me something that had come out in the paper that very day, something very similar, where somebody had had to lift a weight off of somebody. I think it was a car again. And he lifted over 2,000 pounds just to free that person, something he couldn't ever have done normally. Well, how is it possible under hypnosis, or under extreme emotion, or in moments when you just have to do something, how is it possible to do things so amazing? It's because all your energy is going in one way. And so you've got two things going for you here. The block that you introduce into your body by wrong living in one way or another, that has to be freed, of course. The next thing is the energy that you've already got in your body. Learning to focus that energy in one direction, make it a one-way street, instead of blocking it or diffusing it by wanting so many things you don't really clearly know what you want. And in fact, that's a very important thing that I want to touch on again later. And the third aspect to it is to become aware that you are a part of the infinite energy of the universe, and that you can draw on that energy at will. There is no limit to your potential strength once you learn how to attune yourself to that infinite energy. Master taught that we draw that energy through the medulla oblongata at the base of the brain by willpower. And as we bring that energy in through these energization exercises, we learn how to draw on that energy at any time in our lives that we need to. And it's amazing how much strength you have to carry on and do what you need to do if you deliberately summon that infinite source. Your own body will tell you, no, I can't go any further. If you say, I'm a child of God, and I live by His strength, I live by His energy, you'll be amazed to see that you can just keep going. Your body will break down if you abuse it too much. You have to be reasonable. But nonetheless, if you want to live in a state of radiant well-being, then you have to understand that this is the source of that radiance. That radiance is the spiritual energy in the universe, manifested in this body, and manifested through this body, if you will attune yourself to that greater source. Other little physical things are helpful too. I spoke of a harmonious environment. Color is a very important aspect to it too. There are some colors that are more harmonious, other colors that are more disruptive. It's not just the basic colors of red, blue, yellow, etc., the colors of the rainbow. It's rather the quality of each of those colors. Red in itself is often associated with lust, with anger. But on the other hand, red can be very cheery. The difference is that every color has its pure and its impure aspect. A pure red can be very cheerful, very joyful. An impure color, muddy color, dark color, a mixture of black and so on, brown, these tend to lower the mind. You think of blue as a very spiritual color, but there's also the icy cold blue of complete want of feeling, whereas blue is also a color of devotion. So the quality of the color, if you surround yourself with colors that are harmonious with your nature, some people are more in need of red because they're rather too passive. Some people are more in need of blue because they're rather too energetic. You can be too energetic if your energy is always spilling over into action rather than having that sense of calmness and centeredness, which is the essence of real power. And so, find for yourself those colors that are the most harmonious for you, and try to live surrounded by those colors. You will find that certain colors give you joy. You feel as if you were drinking something that you needed, taking into your body a kind of sustenance that was beneficial for it. That's probably because you need that color in your aura. And surrounding yourself with that kind of color, dressing in that color, thinking that kind of color, even inhaling that kind of color. That means to look at the color and inhale and feel as you're inhaling it that you're bringing that color into your whole body. This can be very beneficial. Green is a very healing kind of color. Yellow tends to be more mental. And people who need more mental stimulation could wear yellow. Orange is a very, well, it looks like fire. And so orange has a very strong energy to it. Violet's a very spiritual color. To wear violet helps to expand the consciousness. Each one of these colors has its own particular spiritual vibration, which may be that kind of vibration that you need. But try to stay away from dirty colors, muddy colors. Try to get the pure, light, refreshing colors, those that make your consciousness sort of soar. That will help you very much to get more energy. Music, too, is a very important aspect to drawing the right energy. There is some music that is debilitating. The very act of listening to it makes you feel tired. And there is other music that you just feel energized. Now remember that energy does not necessarily mean nervous energy. It does not necessarily mean active energy. Remember that there's a difference between tamo, rajo, and sattoguna. The gunas are the qualities of nature, and we all have them. Tamoguna is the quality of laziness, darkness, inertia, anything that obscures the consciousness and makes it more dull. Rajoguna is that which activates the mind and sends your energy outward. Sattoguna doesn't seem as energetic because it's very peaceful. And yet this is the true energy. It's the energy of a single bullet as opposed to a shotgun blast going in all directions. The difference between a single laser beam of light as opposed to the light going in all directions from a light bulb. It has power, it has control. And the kind of energy that you see in very rajasic kinds of people, very active people, is an energy that is out of control. There was a very, very interesting, quite charmingly done sort of cartoon book that I read years ago. It was a love affair between a line and a dot. And the line fell in love with this dot and got so excited and wanted to express his love for this dot and started just sort of going in all directions, and you see these lines becoming all sort of frizzy and completely uncontrolled and just a scribble. And the dot, of course, was unimpressed. And then the line began to get very controlled. And then once it got control, it was able to do all these marvelous geometric patterns, very symmetrical. And the dot became very impressed, and then the line and the dot married. Anyway, the message of it was that until you've got control over your energy, you won't be able to accomplish what you're trying to do. And the rajasic kind of person, the person who thinks that he's showing energy because he's letting himself go in Las Vegas, is not the kind of energy that we're talking about, nor is it even really energy. It's a dissipation of force that finally ends in fatigue. People who express energy that way wake up in the morning with a kind of emotional hangover. They're exhausted. They don't know why they feel so grumpy. And they've got to get it together all over again with one of Jesus' pick-me-ups or something. If you can get your energy controlled, and music that helps to control that energy, music that helps to center it, instead of the music that you find yourself jumping up and down with, it looks energetic, doesn't it? People who hear a lot of rock or jazz or discordant music, it sort of irritates the system to a certain point. And it's an interesting phenomenon of nature that a little bit of poison does stimulate. Too much poison kills. A little bit of that kind of energy is needed. We need the balance between rajo and tamo and sattva. Only by the blend of the three can we function well. The need to withdraw from things would be the tamasic element. In itself, it's fine. It's when you overdo it that you become lazy. You constantly withdraw, you never attack, you never get involved, and as a result you just end up vegetating. But a certain amount of that need to withdraw into yourself, that need to withdraw from the outward crises and to get centered, this could be taken in a tamasic as well as a sattvic sense. The withdrawal in itself is tamasic. The centering is sattvic. The returning to the attack would be rajasic. And all these three blended together make the perfect person if you blend them in the right way. Well, that means that there's nothing wrong with a certain amount of outward stimulation, a certain amount of excitement, a certain amount of fun, a certain amount of noise. A certain amount, not too much. Too much is what becomes debilitating. And the more you can surround yourself with things that will bring that energy to a focus, the more you will be able to really have a lot of energy in your life. Don't waste that energy. That's another aspect to it. Wasting it in too much talk, too much sensual enjoyment, too much of anything outward. Try to understand that this source must be constantly replenished, and so live more at your center. Those who don't speak too much, I was just recently, as you know, in Kauai, and I spent 8 days with nobody to relate to except one or two hitchhikers I picked up and a restaurant I went to, that sort of thing. The rest of the time not speaking. And it was really wonderful to not have anyone to relate to for a while. Not that I mean anything personal toward any of you, but it's very good for us sometimes to withdraw and not speak, not use our energies in an outward way so that we can build them up inside. You'll find that then when you direct your energy, it will be directed more wisely, directed with greater focus, and there'll be a lot more power there. The Rajoguna, even though it is an energetic guna in a sense, it isn't radiant. It's merely restless. It's the sattvic quality, the sattvic guna, that is radiant. When people have calmness, when they have this inner joy, I have seen saints in India who didn't even smile much. And yet you could see that joy in their eyes. You could feel it in their vibration. It was an aura that they carried with them and just somehow blessed everyone that they came near. Well, this is the kind of joy that we're really talking about. This is the kind of radiance that we're really talking about. Not that kind of thing that you learn in charm school. Something that comes from deep within yourself. Something that you don't have to try to project. It's just always there. Well, in fact, it is good sometimes to try not to project it, to try to hold it in more, because it turns out to be a very special gift that you give people, and you have to give it somewhat selectively. As you become more sensitive, for example, and you meet people who are not at all in tune with that kind of thinking, if you smile happily at some stranger in the streets who's going grimly about his duties, he may think that you're trying to con him. I came up to some lady in Pasadena years ago. I had a thermos bottle that I'd broken the thermos inside, and I wanted to know where to find a replacement for it. And I saw this lady, and I held this thermos out, and I said, "Could you help me?" Well, you know what she thought. She thought I was asking for a handout. What I was going to ask was, "Where can I find a replacement for this thermos?" But she said, "No," and she turned and walked the other way. And similarly, when you come up to people in the streets smiling, they may completely misunderstand. So you learn to be judicious in the way you radiate. It's not something you want to just radiate all the time outwardly. It's something more inward. It should be really between you and God. The more it's between you and the source of that radiance, the stronger that radiance will be, the stronger that sense of well-being will be. Whereas if you think only of the result of it outwardly, you cut yourself off from the source. Be in tune with the divine. That's where it's really coming from. The environment that you live in, not only eat in, is very important. The people, the company that you keep. If you live with dull people, I know when I've had to stay with dull people, it's very hard not to gradually feel that pall coming over your own mind. There's nothing you can talk about with them. You try to talk about something interesting, they say, yeah. What are you going to say after a while? You certainly don't talk about Vedanta or yoga. You end up talking about the latest football scores. And so, try to be with people who have life. Try to be with people who have joy. Their joy will be a very important part of your joy. Environment is stronger than willpower. It's very difficult to be radiant in an environment that is totally the opposite. And very easy to be radiant if you live with radiant people. That's again why it's so important to live in a community like Ananda, to live with spiritual people, to live with people whose life comes from within instead of seeking their answers always outside themselves. Try to mix with good company all the time, as much as you possibly can. And when you can't help it, then at least keep that consciousness in yourself and always remind yourself that that's where your real strength lies. You'll find a lot of inspiration that way. I had dinner in a restaurant in Kauai the other day, and the pianist was playing and singing some very sort of, very worldly kind of song, and the atmosphere was the typical atmosphere of a resort where people were all laughing and telling jokes and not having a bad time. It wasn't an evil environment. It was pleasant, but completely zero, if you think of spiritual consciousness. And so I was sitting there alone at my table, looking out at a tennis court, but I was feeling inwardly, I was reminding myself, this is where my environment is inside. And I was feeling so much joy in that place, just because I had nobody that I had to talk with, and couldn't hear what they were saying at the table next to me. And so, not that I'd have cared, but I was trying to feel this joy in my spine. And it was so wonderful to understand that wherever you are, you can feel that joy if you just always remember, always bring your consciousness back to it. Live in that consciousness, and you'll find that just driving down the highway can be a kind of meditation. So, yes, if you can't be in the right environment, Master said to Bernard one time that the important thing is environment. He said the way to develop devotion rather than emotion is to be with devotees rather than worldly people, for example. And Bernard said, well, what if I'm by myself? And Master said, am I not always with you? Remember that answer. Is he not always with you? Is God not always with you? And if you live in that consciousness and always remember his presence within, then to be alone may be the best thing of all. You can be alone with God in a crowd and never be alone. I was amused. I read something yesterday. Nobody's ever lonely eating spaghetti. I thought, goodness, what does he possibly mean? I guess he meant you're so busy that you don't think about being lonely. Well, you also cannot be lonely if you think of God all the time. Be busy with God. Be busy inwardly just thinking of him, and you'll find that wherever you are, there is joy. So, company is important, but the most important company of all is godly company, is the company of God, I mean, inside. Environment is important, but if you can't be in an ashram, then wherever you are, put out the energy consciously to feel yourself surrounded by him. Feel him in the air around you. Feel him in the movement of the trees. Even in a restaurant, feel him in the people and the waiters bustling around and the smells and the sounds and everything. And you'll be surprised how, in the end, you'll start to feel inspiration from anything and everything, because you'll know that God is acting through these things, through these people. It's God in everything, sometimes God not acting wisely because people cover up that inspiration in themselves, but nonetheless they are still a part of his dream. Raising the consciousness is a very important aspect of living radiantly. Raising the consciousness in the spine, raising the consciousness, the more you can live in the upper part of your body consciously, the more you will feel always happy. Notice this. Whenever you feel unhappy, you'll notice that the consciousness comes down. Or, conversely, Anytime your consciousness comes down, notice whether you feel happy or not. You won't feel happy. Anytime there is a lowering of energy in the body, a lowering of consciousness into what the yogis describe as the lower chakras, but people who don't know anything about chakras can still relate to this, that when there's a heavy feeling, when there's a downward feeling, we use those words in our language, and I'm sure they have them in all languages. I feel high, I feel low. Everybody knows what those words mean. You don't need to have them explained to you. I feel uplifted, I feel downcast. All our words relate to this. It's a certain knowledge that is born of a deep intuition of the soul, deeper than conscious knowledge, but we all have it, that when we grow spiritually back to our source, all the energy in the body becomes united in the upper centers and finally becomes united here in the spiritual eye and then in the thousand-petaled lotus. And nobody is made in a different way. We are all made basically according to the same pattern, that energy comes out into the body, and before we attain divine enlightenment, it has to go back and become united. This is the meaning of yoga, union, bringing all that energy into one at the top of the head. Now, there are a lot of psychologists and psychiatrists who think that, yes, we need to become united. Yes, we've got to bring all the energy together into one focus. And then they get a hold of the wrong end of the telescope. And they say, what keeps our energy from being focused in one thing? Well, we try to enjoy something and then we feel guilty about it. If we could just stop feeling guilty, then we would be able to enjoy it completely. And the kinds of enjoyment that these people know all relate to the lower chakras. They relate to having a good time in this world. And they don't know anything about spiritual joy because they're trying to be scientists. And science is basically a physical thing. And to try to be on a par with physicists and chemists and so on, they try to approach the body in that way, in a physical way, and try to explain it in physical ways. And so their natural bent leads them to this conclusion, that if you want to become completely united, overcome those things that prevent you from being completely focused in your lower chakras. Live without restraint. Live without the feeling of guilt. Don't suppress. And you will find that if you live completely physically, forget all this gilding of the lily of high ideals and artistic sensitivity and so on. In mental hospitals, you will see signs warning guests not to bring spiritual writings to the patients there. And this is all a part of that same psychology. Granted that many of the delusions of mentally unwell people have to do with religious ideas, I'm Jesus Christ or something, but the truth is still that spiritual consciousness is the only final cure. And it's only when they resolve it in that way, rather than giving up the spiritual side, that they will finally be able to come out of those woods. Anyway, this is not a solution, is it? When people try to live in that way, getting rid of all those things that would prevent them from being completely hedonists, they find sooner or later living that way that they are not happy. They are living with less and less energy, less and less joy, less and less ability to concentrate. They get divorced at the drop of a hat. They can't be loyal to anybody. They can't be go in any single direction for any length of time. They just become so scattered and so restless and so nervous that finally their lives just fall apart underneath them. The principle is true. The psychologists are not wrong. It's that they've just simply gone the wrong direction. If we take that same principle and realize that we can never become completely united in the lower part of our body, because that's not where we are. That's not our center. That's a place to which we have gone from our center. We have projected ourselves from that deeper sense into that outward state. And we will attain that center only when we go back to the deeper self within. When we find that center within of spiritual consciousness, then we will be able to find that state of union completely, where there will be no need for anything else. So, if you want to be happy, do everything that you can to raise your consciousness. That means live more centered here at the point between the eyebrows, or in the heart center, opposite the heart and the spine. Try to bring your energy upward by deep breathing even, sitting up straight, looking up more, smiling more. Even when you sit, sit upright. Don't just collapse and sit halfway up your spine on the sofa. When you walk, walk on your toes, on the balls of your feet more. Don't stand heavily on your heels. All these things will help to bring your consciousness upward. Even in the yoga postures, it's a very helpful aspect of the yoga postures to come up more on your toes. When you come up into the tree pose, for example, or in the full breathing, yogic breathing, or coming down in Utkatasana into the chair pose, come up first on the balls of your feet and then come down on your toes into that position so that you feel the lightness of it. And hold that position for a while to strengthen that consciousness that even squatted down like that, nonetheless, you are light. To be able, I used to, when giving these classes, I used to show people that I could go down on one leg and do it 10 times easily, just on one leg, up and down, by that feeling of lightness in the body that comes when you learn to live more in that consciousness. Ramakrishna used to weigh the arms of people when they would come to him. He would hold their forearm. And if the forearm was light, that meant they were spiritual. If it was heavy, he could tell that they had a very heavy consciousness. And it isn't probably a matter of actual weight. That would have to do with how much muscles you've got and bones and fat and everything. But there was more just that consciousness that made everything about you lift. You'll notice that people with a heavy consciousness, they look down, their shoulders sag, lumps, that's what they are. And as you grow spiritually, spiritual people, their hands automatically rise more. There is, everything about them has this sense of upwardness. So when you sit down, put yourself in the seat, don't collapse. When you lie in bed, lay yourself down. When you stand up, come up lightly. When you stand, stand more on the balls of your feet. Stand more forward. Don't sit back. Everything that you can do to bring that consciousness upward will help you to become really radiant. Now, this is not a long-suppressed secret, but it's a long-ignored secret, isn't it? Very few people know it, and yet subconsciously everybody knows it. Everybody knows that they feel better when they feel high and worse when they feel low. Try it. Try looking up more. Not just always looking down and use affirmations in that way. Don't use heavy expressions. Use expressions that denote joy. The affirmations that you make as soon as you wake up in the morning, I'm awake and ready and all this to make you feel that, it goes into your subconscious mind and that makes you automatically lighter. Sending the right kinds of affirmations to your subconsciousness are really important. Don't affirm those things that you want to overcome. Speak the truth and let that truth express the higher aspect of reality, not the lower. Facts and truth are not always the same. It may be a fact that you feel absolutely miserable, debilitated, and sick. But it won't help you to say, I feel miserable, debilitated, and sick. I feel miserable, debilitated, and sick. It won't help you. You'll get more miserable, more debilitated, and sicker. But if you say, I'm well, and I'm energetic, and I feel wonderful, and I'm... You'll find that bit by bit you can be in a hospital, and even so, you'll get well. I mentioned this, I think, in my... I was in the hospital in Mexico City years ago. What happened was that I came down with streptococcus infection, tonsillitis, dysentery. I was so ill that for 2 or 3 days I couldn't even go to a doctor. And Bob Watson, in whose house I was staying, was a strange fellow, very nice, but he was intolerant of sickness. So as soon as I became sick, he just turned his back and didn't want anything to do with me. Closed the door and I was just on my own. Finally, after 3 days, I was well enough to go out and see a doctor, and he took me out and gave me a big steak dinner. I ate meat in those days. Stupid thing to do, but again, he refused to admit that sickness was a part of reality. I suppose there are people like that. I don't think it's the way to get out of it, really. Didn't help me much, but anyway. I then staggered off to a doctor, and the doctor examined me, and he said, "My God, you've got to get to a hospital." Here I was starting to get well, but anyway, I was still very sick. And so he put me in the hospital, and I asked him how long I'd be there. He said, "Well, you might as well resign yourself to being here at least 2 weeks." And I made a few discreet inquiries as to how much it would cost to be there 2 weeks. Well, I didn't have the money. I didn't know anything about yoga, but I did know I had to get out of that hospital. Do you know I was out of there in 2 days, completely well? I made myself well just by having to get well. And a lot of people have done that too. A friend of mine who treated polio patients, he was a physiotherapist, he said that the poor patients very often got well where the rich ones didn't, because the poor patients couldn't afford to stay there. The rich ones stayed long enough for their paralysis to become a habit. And I talked to one woman who had had polio. When I knew her, she was a very big, very strong woman. She was a cook and carried things that it would take two or three people to carry normally. And yet she had had polio. And she was so physical in her attitude toward life that the thought of being paralyzed was just unconscionable to her. And she would be lying there in bed and just force herself out onto the floor, and she'd just be huddled against the wall, and she'd make that leg move, and just with willpower she didn't know about energy, but she'd just send that thought, which in fact was energy, to her body to make it move and make it behave. And bit by bit it started to respond. And when I knew her, you'd never have known she'd had polio, but she did it because she had to. And if a person can do that with that consciousness, how much more easily can he do it when he knows that energy can make you well, when he knows that the affirmation that I'm well can go into the subconscious and make you well? Live in that way, and you'll find that that's a higher aspect of truth, that even if you're living just barely existing on a hospital bed, and if you tell yourself I'm well, it may not be a fact, but it will be a truth, which you can manifest in the outward world by that affirmation. Always affirm those states of consciousness that you want to develop, and you'll find that you have them. Tell yourself, "I'm a saint," and you'll become a saint. Tell yourself, "I am free from all these delusions," and you'll become free of these delusions. You have to take the common sense steps in between, naturally. But while taking those common sense steps of meditating and gradually learning to see the light and identify yourself with the light and so on, still, even from the very start of your spiritual journey, tell yourself, "I'm a child of God, I'm perfect, I'm free, I'm full of joy." Practice contentment. Master said to somebody who had a tendency to be moody, he said, "Remember this, if you make up your mind to be happy, no one in the world will be able to make you unhappy. But if you make up your mind to be unhappy, no one in the world will be able to make you happy." You have to have that attitude yourself. You will never get it by waiting for the world to give it to you. You'll never get it by waiting for circumstances to finally break in the right way. Happiness, contentment, is a deliberate attitude that you've got to assume. And once you've assumed it, you can have it in the face of death itself, in the face of disaster, in the face of everything, you can be happy. As long as you are a part of the infinite joy. Nobody can take that from you. No torture, no imprisonment, no bereavement, nothing can take it from you. You are that. That is your birthright. So live in that consciousness, and you will find that in that way you can be radiant, and no other condition need really matter. And you know that a happy person is likely, even if he eats badly, to be well. Or an unhappy person, no matter how well he eats, is somehow his body's not going to use that food rightly, and he'll be unwell. So if you want to live right, don't think only in terms of right physical diet. Think in terms of right mental diet. Joyful thoughts, loving thoughts, devotion. Why? Ultimately, Master said that will is the switch that draws the energy from the universe into the body. The greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. Willingness. When you're willing to do something, you find that you have the energy to do it. When you're unwilling, you find somehow you don't have any energy. It's not only that you block that flow by a negative thought, you also block the inflow from the infinite when you shut off the willpower. Willpower is the switch, as I said, that draws energy into the body. The greater the will, the greater the willingness, the greater the flow of energy. And a happy attitude is a willing attitude. When you're happy, that energy is flowing all the time. Sri Yukteswar said another very interesting thing. He said that when you can develop the heart's natural love, the harmony of that love flows through the whole body and makes the whole body well. Live in the thought of devotion, live in the thought of God's love, and you'll find that somehow everything becomes better. This is the kind of mental diet that I'm talking about. Mental and spiritual diet is much more important than just physical diet. And remember again, I want to reiterate it, food and physical means are not going to give you radiance. They will give you a vehicle that will make it easier for you to express radiance, but radiance is an essentially spiritual quality and has to be drawn from that source. Desire versus desirelessness is another very important aspect of it. Desire, you see, is an affirmation of lack. When you say, I want something, you're also saying, I won't be happy until I get it. As soon as you have a desire, there's this thought that, oh, I need that to be fulfilled. And the thing is that once you've fulfilled that desire, there's first of all that, yes, there is a certain release to begin with. Rajneesh talks a lot about the release that you get from fulfilling your emotions, fulfilling your desires. I take the strongest possible exception to that teaching. If he were to confront yogis, people steeped in the old tradition, with new things that could shake that tradition, fine, that's stimulating. We need a little bit of controversy to come up with new ways of seeing things. But to take this teaching and give it to people who are totally green and don't know anything, what happens really when you decide that I'm going to just go ahead and indulge and enjoy and call it spiritual, which is about what the teaching involves? What happens? You set a certain current going. And yes, you feel better for getting out of your system. You feel fine for a minute. The thing is, you've already started that energy going in that way, and so you're likely to go that way again in the future. You may not want to tomorrow, but by the day after tomorrow, you'll get your energy back enough to want to do that all over again, whether it be expression of sex, of anger, of anything. We don't fulfill desire by just fulfilling it. It may be necessary to fulfill it to some extent in order to get your mind somewhat freed to concentrate on the positive side, but fulfillment doesn't ever come by just outward fulfillment. That's a temporary measure. Real fulfillment comes by realizing that you are complete in yourself and you don't need anything in order to be fulfilled. And this means trying bit by bit to curb your desires. Not to create new and newer desires, but to learn to tell myself, no, I don't need this. Or, if you have the desire, turn it in a good direction. If you have a desire, you may find that one very good way to overcome that desire is to fulfill it, but not for yourself. Buy a thing and give it to somebody else. You've bought it, but you've expanded your consciousness and you've released it, and there's a great feeling of freedom then. There's a sense of freedom that comes in giving, in sharing, and in the opportunity to share. So, desirelessness can be achieved to some extent, yes, by fulfilling the desire, but always if you can expand your consciousness. You will never be radiant so long as you think only of I and mine. Selfish people are never happy people. Radiance comes when you expand your consciousness, and expansion of consciousness comes by learning to live through others, to feel that they are a part of you. The more you can feel that their happiness is vital to your happiness, the more you can feel that your happiness is involved when you make them happy, the more you will know what real happiness is, the more you will radiate. You will never see selfish people radiant, and you will always see people who are genuinely unselfish, not those people who are unselfish because they'd feel guilty if they weren't. Not those people who are unselfish because it's a sort of a Christian duty that's been imposed upon them, and they're doing their good deed for the day, chalking up that many more years in heaven, or whatever it might be, or that many years off of purgatory. Do it for the simple and sheer joy of doing it. Understand that this is selfishness of a divine type. To do it because it makes you happy to do something for others, then you will be able to be radiantly happy.